This is Tim O'Brien with O'Reilly Media.
Today I interviewed U.S. Congressman John Culbertson of the 7th District of Texas in the U.S. House of Representatives. On Wednesday, John Culbertson sounded the alarm on Twitter about the Franken Commission's efforts to reconsider member access to sites such as Twitter and Quick. His initial call to arms on Wednesday contained some partisan elements. He was accusing the Democrats of trying to limit member access to sites such as Twitter. Culbertson was responding to a letter written by Michael Capuano, who is the representative representing the 8th District of Massachusetts, also in the House of Representatives. Michael Capuano serves as the chair of the Congressional Commission on Mailing Standards, otherwise known as the Franken Commission. In short, the Franken Commission exists as a way to ensure that a member of Congress doesn't use the privileges of being able to communicate freely with constituents as an unfair advantage in a re-election campaign. So the Franken Commission gets involved in mail, but also in electronic communications. When a member wants to link to their re-election campaign website from their official house.gov site, the Franken Commission has a number of rules that are involved. Some of these rules are a little outdated. For example, members are not allowed to participate in sites that include advertising, Twitter or Quick or YouTube. Capuano wrote this letter as an attempt to start the ball rolling on some reforms in the Franken Commission, and Culbertson reacted with a partisan attack. While Culbertson does use this interview as an opportunity to back down from the partisan rhetoric, you do get the sense that there is still an underlying disagreement between him and Capuano. I begin the interview by asking him if anyone in Congress has ever asked him to stop streaming live video. In terms of your use of Quick, has anyone ever said, listen, I just don't want to be recorded, turn it off?
Sure.
Who and where and when?
Well, I've already told the New York Times this, so but my friend Mike Capuano, who is a good man with a good heart and good intentions, he represents Boston, he's the chairman of the Franken Committee, and he and I are genuinely good friends. I like him, and we get along very well. The other day, when I first approached him on this, and we discussed this, and I told him, first of all, Mike, I couldn't find him on the House floor on, what was it, Tuesday, when all this first blew up. And I wanted to talk to him before I, you know, launched on Twitter. I told him I wouldn't launch on him again until I talked to him first, and that's just, you know, the fair thing to do as a friend. And I also promised him I'm going to keep Democrat or Republican out of it. I think that's appropriate because this whole debate is about First Amendment rights, access to government, and it's too important for anybody to be distracted by partisan labels. So I told Mike that I'd keep the Democrat or Republican out of it, and I suggested to him then, this is one Wednesday, I said, you know, Mike, the solution to this is to treat the new media as we do old media. There's no way to regulate the new media. You're going to have about as much success as King Canute of the Vikings did when he told his men to put his throne on the edge of the waves at the beach, and he tried to order the tide not to come in. You just can't regulate it like regulating the wind. And he fundamentally agrees. And I said, well, Mike, you know, I know you and I are on the same page on this. I said, I got my Quick camera right here. Let's go out on the porch and just do an interview. He just wasn't ready yet. He said, I don't want to go on the record yet. And I don't, that's his, he's the chairman and he'll talk about this in due time. And I've had others say they didn't want to do it, but there's no reason other than that one. And I know Mike is okay with me talking about it because I defend his right to wait until he's ready to talk about it. He's a good guy, and we're working towards a good solution on this.
Some people have attacked you for making the issue a bit more partisan than it needed to be.
Absolutely, I agree. And I never should have brought up Democrat or Republican. That's one of the wonderful things about the Internet is that I was able to get some. I got, obviously overwhelming support for this. But my goal is not, I'm not approaching this as a Republican. I made a mistake in even mentioning Democrat or Republican. I'm always going to talk about the House leadership, and that's a distraction, and it's unnecessary. It's simply, the goal is to shine sunlight into Congress. And I'll keep partisan labels out of it, and I'm going to stay focused on the goal. The two things the Internet's helped me do, the community has helped me understand to keep the partisan labels out of it. That's good advice, which I have taken to heart. And the other good advice I got was that, I mean, actually, and through this debate, and Techno Sailor in particular, I don't know who he is, I think his name's Aaron, had some really good posts on his blog that kind of, when you walk through his and a couple of other good blogs out there, I realized that I was targeting the wrong thing, that the existing rules make it illegal for me to post on Twitter, to post on the Quick website. The existing rules, I'm operating in the twilight zone. And so it helped me realize that my focus needs to be that the Congress should treat congressional access to the new social media in the same way that Congress treats our access to the old traditional media. I was just interviewed by the New York Times before I called you, and the reporter for the New York Times asked me a similar question. And I asked him, I said, now this interview, if your editors decide to use it in the print paper, will be published in a newspaper that's going to contain commercial and political ads, right? He said, well, yeah, sure. And I said, if you use it on the website, you're going to have commercial and political ads on the website. Well, of course, you got to pay for the website. So therefore, there's no logical distinction, Tim, between the old media and the new media, because the logic of what Capuano and the leadership want to do is they say it's inappropriate for us to post on a website that contains political speech, recommendations on elections, or commercial advertising. Well, then why don't they keep us out of the newspapers? Why don't they keep us off of television? Why don't they keep us off of the radio? There's no distinction. So the internet community has helped me realize that that needs to be the focus, and that's where I'm zeroed in, and there will be no more mention of party label.
From your experience, how many members of Congress actually want you to be able to Twitter from the floor, and how many do not?
I couldn't put a number on it. Everyone I've spoken to has been supportive of what I'm doing. There's some members that are as fascinated with technology as I am. I am particularly fascinated with technology. I love science. I love technology. I've always loved computers. I think I was the first elected official in the country to set up a legislative information bulletin board. I used a Macintosh Lisa in 1987 when I was first sworn into the Texas House of Representatives. I was in my second year of law school, and I had a Macintosh Lisa, and I used a program called White Knight. It was a White Knight bulletin board system, and my staff and I would type in legislative information, the House floor calendar, the schedule, what I was doing, and then on, I think, Tuesdays or Thursday nights, I would get on the bulletin board live, and people could actually type me questions live, and I could respond. I remember there was a man that was blind that said he had a voice synthesizer on his computer, and he would use my legislative bulletin board information system to keep him updated on what the Texas legislature was doing. So this is nothing new to me. I've always loved being at the frontier, the cutting edge of technology, and everyone I've talked to on the House floors liked it and been a little charmed by it and interested and have a little fun teasing me about all the devices on my belt. My wife in particular has told me that I can't put them all on my belt or she's going to pretend she doesn't know me. She says I define nerd. She's here in the room with me.
You said you want to be a real-time representative.
Yes.
On Quick. As more of your constituents realize that you're online, that you're on Twitter, on Quick, are you afraid that you're going to reach a point where it's going to be overwhelming, where the business of responding to this media is going to distract you from representing your district?
Not yet. I mean, I'll reach a point where I may ultimately have to, in terms of the direct, I've already got about 1,200 followers, and right now, let me see how many, I got to refresh it. I think I've got, let me look at it and see. I've got 235 direct messages. I'm probably about 35 or 40 direct messages behind. I have 26. I've got 1,126 followers. Yeah, I could get overwhelmed here fairly soon. The only time I really get to look at it is in the evening and periodically during the day. After my family goes to bed is when I'll jump on the computer because I'm a night owl anyway. But yeah, I could reach a point where it gets overwhelming and I may need to limit the direct messages if there's a way to filter Twitter to people that are actually, for example, I may try Texans first, and then if that gets too big, then I'll try to limit it to Houstonians, and I may have to limit it to District 7 and answer the others when I can. I may, try to get, maybe there's a way to filter it so I can prioritize them, so I'm answering the ones from constituents first.
What equipment do you use to Twitter and Quick?
Well, I can Twitter directly from my computer here in the office. I also Twitter from, I obviously have to have I can't do any campaign work out of here. I'm reminded of George. Two of my favorite shows are Seinfeld and Raymond. And I don't know if you ever watched Seinfeld, but you remember when George had the girlfriend and then Jerry brought the girlfriend to the apartment. But anyway, George, went wild because the girlfriend could never go to the apartment because the two worlds, would go boom. I have to keep the campaign in the federal office completely separate. So I have a campaign computer, an office set up at home so I can, we'll Twitter from that one. I'll also keep up with my all my other the blogs and whatnot from both computers. Another point that I made in the interview with the leadership is, frankly, I conducted the interview just before yours with the New York Times on this same phone in my official capacity on an official telephone from my office in Washington. How do you distinguish? There's no way to distinguish. So just get rid of all the rules. It's ridiculous. Use common sense. I can't campaign or enrich myself using official resources. I can't video from the House floor. Just, you know, trust us. So I'm using both. I'm using both the computer desktop, and I'm also Twittering using a BlackBerry, a campaign BlackBerry, the federal BlackBerry, and then I can do the quick videos. I have a Nokia 95 8 gig phone that does the high resolution streaming video, but I'm not sure yet. House franking does not know what to do with me. They're not sure how to categorize me. My wife says she doesn't know what to do with me. Because I'm, you know, for example, they can't figure out. The other night I figured out. I figured out I could put I do telephone town hall meetings, Tim, where I have a software program that'll dial, say, 70 to 100,000 households in my district, and they can listen into a conference call like this one, and they can ask me questions live on the phone. So I did a combination the other night, telephone town hall meeting using live streaming video. They could watch me on the website, on my website. They could text me questions on my website. They could talk to me on the telephone, or they could ask me questions on Twitter. House franking has no clue what to do with that. They can't even figure out how to get their arms around it. So I was told once I can quick with my federal phone. Mike Capuano the other day told me he thinks I have to use my campaign phone. Who knows? We're still working it out.
Your opponent in this year's election is Michael Skelly. He's a former wind energy executive. Given your support for the expansion of drilling offshore and exploration for oil resources, I want to know how you feel that wind energy specifically can fit into the mix.
Mm-hmm. That's an easy question. Wind energy is an important part of the solution to make America energy independent. We need to basically check all the boxes on the list of things that we need to do to make America energy independent, but we need to do it without subsidies. I strenuously oppose subsidies for any industry out there, and it is heavily subsidized, as is ethanol, as is biofuels, as are a number of other alternative energy sources. And I particularly resent the fact that the majority party in Congress passed a $15 billion tax increase on just the American oil companies late last year, and then handed the money over to the alternative energy guys. So essentially, part of the money you pay at the pump when you're, you know, filling up your car with a $70 tank of gas, a chunk of that money is going straight to these alternative energy guys that are heavily subsidized. So that's just wrong. I'm a free market Jeffersonian Republican, and particularly with the price of oil at $130, $140, $150 a barrel, the competition, the alternative energy guys should certainly be able to compete without subsidies.
As a representative from Texas, do you agree or disagree with the statement that the United States needs to move away from fossil fuels towards an economy based more on renewables such as wind or solar?
Yes, I'm passionate about shifting away from a fossil fuel economy and looking to invest in the long-term energy independence of the United States. And the way we get there, Tim, initially is to drill here, drill now, and we will pay less. In every domestic oil field that we can access, we should be drilling. It can be done cleanly. I'm proud to represent many of the major oil companies in the United States. And I know I'm like a fourth generation Houstonian, fifth generation Texan, and they're drilling right off the beach at Galveston. You can stand on the seawall at Galveston and see the jackup oil rigs a few hundred yards offshore. There's no tar balls. There's no pollution. Hurricane Ivan, for example, severed multiple underwater oil pipelines. There were no leaks because the technology is so good. They can drill cleanly, safely, anywhere in the world. And we've got vast quantities of natural resources, oil, natural gas, shale oil. There's more shale oil in the United States than there is oil in the entire Middle East. Schlumberger estimates about 4 trillion barrels of recoverable shale oil in 3 western states alone, and there's about a trillion barrels of oil in the ground in the Middle East. So short term, drill here, drill now, pay less. Intermediate term, you know, we've got to open up shale oil, liquefied coal, nuclear power. I frankly personally think we ought to build, since Nevada is 99% federally owned, we ought to build, you know, 25, 30 nuclear power plants in Nevada and you know, store the waste right there. Then you have all the waste right there. I don't know if you need 25 or 30, but build a bunch of nuclear power plants in Nevada to take much of the western United States off of coal-fired or natural gas-fired plants, and you could store the waste right there in Nevada. And then for the and of course that intermediate equation is going to need to include wind energy and biofuels, but just let them do it on the marketplace. They ought to be able to do it without the subsidies. And then finally, for the long term, to wrap up a long answer to an important question, in my mind, best solution is to make America energy independent is nanotechnology, and in particular, carbon nanotubes. I represent Rice University. Dr. Rick Smalley, who just passed away a year ago, October, Nobel Prize winning scientist at Rice, who discovered the structure of the carbon-60 molecule, Buckyball, who was the first to manufacture or produce carbon nanotubes and recoverable quantities, and his laboratory, which is the named after him, the Smalley Institute at Rice, is developing the quantum wire, which is using carbon nanotubes. You're attempting to spin them into wires so that you could transmit, not conduct, but transmit electricity from Los Angeles to New York on a wire the width of your little finger and carry 10 to 20 times the electricity carried on those gigantic overhead power lines with zero loss of electricity due to resistance or electromagnetic radiation, because the electrons are travel ballistically down this hollow carbon nanotube. And then finally, the carbon nanotube technology, Tim, will allow us to build a machine about the size of a washing machine that would be able to store electricity. You could buy it off the grid at night, store it, and then run all of your appliances and charge up your electric car, which carbon nanotubes will solve the battery storage problem. The carbon nanotubes allow you to store that electricity in this device in your home. And then you've got a truly distributed network, which coupled with intelligent electric meters, which CenterPoint Energy in Houston is one of the first in the nation to distribute, the consumer will be able to monitor their use of electricity using the intelligent meter, choose to run the washing machine or dryer at night when there's less draw on the grid. They'll be able to use this washing machine device to run all the devices in their home on their own. And that right there, that solution right there, the distributed network, individual consumers, free people making free choices in a free market, will allow the United States to become completely energy independent in the years to come.
Many of the solutions to the energy problem that you just discussed require a commitment to scientific research.
I'm passionate about it.
Given your commitment to science, do you think America's losing its edge? We're about to lay off particle physicists at Fermilab, and NASA's about to enter into a four-year period between 2010 and the completion of the Ares rocket, during which it will lose the capability to launch a human into space.
It's appalling.
You sit on the House Appropriations Committee. What are your priorities for fiscal year 2009 in terms of science and research?
Top priority needs to be to double the budget of the National Science Foundation. Congress needs to double the budget of the National Institute of Health. We need to double the investment that we're making in energy research through the Department of Energy and create a Manhattan-style project of making America energy independent in the next 10 years. And at the same time, making sure that we maintain our competitive edge in the world through this, through a massive investment through the National Science Foundation. And then also, I think we should also do a Manhattan-style project of curing cancer with investment through the competitive peer review grant process at the National Institute of Health. I actually feel very strongly that it is not the job of Congress or politicians or elected officials to micromanage or direct the spending of scientific research dollars. That should all be driven by the scientists or the engineers or the doctors through a pure, peer-reviewed competitive grant process that they do so well. And the problem is the Congress has invested money on and up and down, on, you know, from year to year, the funding bounces around. And we need a steady, predictable growth pattern with a commitment by the Congress over 5-year to 7-year period, whatever it takes, to double the amount of money we're spending on peer-reviewed scientific grants at the National Science Foundation, the National Institute of Health, the Energy Department, and frankly, the National Institutes of Standard and Technology, and get out of the way and let the scientists and engineers drive the dollars. It's not only Fermilab, Tim, but you know, and it's not only the fact that we will not be able to launch a human into space for a period of about 5 years. We will not have, I think, all we're going to lose all the particle accelerators. Europe is going to have all of the particle accelerators in a matter of years. We won't, I think, have any. We may have one particle accelerator physics for the fundamental research that has to be down to the nature of matter with the high-energy particle accelerators. Those will all be shut down in the United States. We're not doing the fundamental research that we need to do in aerodynamics. There's unfortunately a short-term mentality that is all too prevalent in Congress and in the executive branch, Democrat and Republican, tend not to think about the long-term investment in the sciences. I see it as a national insurance policy. The best way to assure the future economic prosperity of the country is to invest in the sciences. So you won't get any disagreement with me out of that. I'm a ardent fiscal conservative. The starting answer for me is no on all new spending. It's hard to get to yes. I'm on the Appropriations Committee. I don't like to spend money. I don't want to add to the national debt or the deficit. But the one area we've got to invest big dollars in is in the National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health, and fundamental scientific research. So no argument with me there.
In the past, you've voted against stem cell research. Could you reconcile that vote with the statement that you just made that we should let the scientists decide which science to fund, that we should, quote, get out of the way?
Well, we have law should always favor life. Law should always create an environment that favors life. And if the law creates an environment in which it is permissible to create human beings for the purpose of harvesting them like a crop of corn, I think that's an appalling and dangerous world we're entering into. And the problem I've always had with the bills that we've been presented with is that no matter how they've been drafted and no matter how carefully they tell me they have tried to design them, each bill creates an atmosphere in which it is perfectly legal to create a batch of fertilized human embryos for the purpose of dropping them into a blender and harvesting them like a crop of corn. And my daughter, our kids, you, Tim, you are not an ear of corn.
Speaking of corn, do we need tighter or stricter regulations on genetically modified crops? Are we playing with fire?
No, I don't have any problem with that. I mean, that's a crop, that's a plant. I have absolutely no problem. Science, the increases we've seen in America in productivity, the tremendous advantage that America has always had since we've been created is a direct result of individual freedom, and that freedom has to extend to the scientific community in particular, and you've got to let the scientists and the engineers and the doctors drive the research. But the law fundamentally has got to draw some boundaries of fundamental, there's got to be a fundamental moral foundation to the nation that is defined by the law. And if the law permits human beings to be created and harvested like a crop of corn, it's just, I think, an extraordinarily dangerous and appalling future that we've set out for ourselves. It's just, I think, something that morally you can't justify. If there are, for example, I think the president was right to set aside existing stem cell lines. There's apparently more of the lines that he set forth, there's only a handful that are actually viable. But I would point you to, I've been a subscriber to the journals Nature and Science for many, 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 many years. I'm an amateur astronomer, an amateur geologist, always loved planetary sciences, a mineral and fossil collector. I've always been fascinated with science. So I read those journals cover to cover. I don't pretend to completely understand a lot of the molecular, the biological articles that I read, but I have a pretty good grasp on a lot of the others, and I have seen articles, as for example, recently in the November, and one of the November 2007 issues of Nature, they reported on a group of Japanese scientists who added 5 growth factors to adult stem cells and converted those adult skin cells into pluripotent stem cells that could then could grow into any number of different things. Now, if we're able to extract stem cells from amniotic fluid, which they can, if you're able to convert adult cells into stem cells, which we can, if they're able to extract stem cells from other sources, if you're able to extract and create stem cells from any source other than a human embryo, you don't even need to go there. You don't need to create an environment in which human beings are created for the purpose of harvesting them, by, like a crop of corn.